It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz in for Kate Archer Kent. In 1964, the U.S. government committed to tackling poverty in the country.
Many Americans live on the outskirts of hope. Some because of their poverty, and some because of their color. And all too many because of both. Our task is to help replace their despair with opportunity. And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson in his first State of the Union address. Medicare and Medicaid were created. Social Security was expanded. Food stamps began. More than half a century later, how are we doing on that promise? What do you think is holding back families and children in Wisconsin today? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Michelle Mackey is the Chief Executive Officer of Kids Forward. Kids Forward is a nonprofit research and advocacy organization that focuses on the well-being of children and families. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. It's very nice to be with you today.
I'm glad you could join us. When you look at the data, what are the biggest needs facing children and families in Wisconsin today?
Yes, you know, even before the pandemic, what we were seeing were children and families struggling a bit across our state. We're seeing that is really indicated by zip code and by race, unfortunately. And so we see that in our rural communities, children and families are struggling with having a disparity in health outcomes, in health costs, and also in terms of broadband access, which we've heard get a lot of publicity over the pandemic. We also know that there are impacts to having a high school diploma or even a bachelor's degree that cause disparity in rural counties. And so your bachelor's degree may not be worth as much in a rural county due to income disparity. And so we've seen this over time, over coming out of the Great Recession and not seeing the same kind of improvements for rural families and rural children that we've seen in other parts of the state. And then, of course, we all know that Wisconsin is one of the worst places in the country to grow up if you're a Black child. We have Milwaukee, which is one of the most segregated cities in the nation. We have demonstrated that we have extreme disparities in Dane County. And so we also saw with communities of color that they did not progress and they did not see the kind of prosperity that white families saw coming out of the Great Recession. And then, of course, we have the pandemic, and that complicated the situation. We saw many of our systems break down under the strain. And when you have that happen, the folks that get most impacted are those that have always been marginalized. So, again, children and families of color and those that are rural in rural Wisconsin.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the disparities we have in this state, I mean, when you look at the numbers, 1 in 10 Wisconsinites live in poverty. But that number, it's 1 in 4 for Native Americans, for African Americans. It's 1 in 5 for Latinos in our state. Why? Why do these disparities exist?
You know, I think really what we've seen with the research and the data is that, unfortunately, systemic racism has pervaded our structures and our policies. And what that means is that when you're looking at outcomes for communities of color, they start at a disadvantage. From the moment that they're born, even pre-birth, because we know that maternal health statistics are poor for communities of color, even before they're born, they're born in a way at a disadvantage given our social structures and our systems. Many communities of color have great assets that they have built up over time to try and have productive and effective lives and thriving lives for children and families. But though the structures that surround our ecosystem of supports, everything from healthcare to education, those have systemic racism baked within them. They were founded on systemic racism in many ways, these policies. And because of that, it's very difficult for a child or family to navigate our world and have outcomes that don't create disparity or show disparity.
And one of the things your organization is known for is the Race to Equity report drilling into that data in Dane County. And I understand you're expanding that.
Yeah, so what we're looking at, because data sort of lags coming, we use public data out of usually the census and American survey. So that data lags by up to 2 years. And what we had done was we gotten through 2017 and we were able to show a pre-pandemic view of what it was like to be a Black person in Dane County. And then the pandemic hit. And what we realized was, while that pre-pandemic story is very important, it gives a baseline. It shows that what how long it took coming out of the Great Recession for Black families and Black children to start to see some of the prosperity that others were experiencing. What we really needed to be able to do is tell that story and then also tell what we could of the pandemic story. And so we actually have a piece that just came out called Pandemic Pain Points. And it just talks a bit about Wisconsin level data and the disparity. And then we'll be using similar analysis to tell the story of the pandemic for those in Dane County. And so we're looking to release the pre-pandemic story this year and then follow very quickly with the pandemic story to the extent that the data is available. And that data will be coming out over the course of 2 years. So we'll keep telling the story as we have the data.
Sure. And I wonder what you think about the universal basic income idea. We've seen 11 cities now across the country mm-hmm. that have started pilot programs. This is where governments will directly pay families. What do you think of that idea?
Yeah, I think we should try it. You know, there we often wrote, right, it gets forward about the growing economic inequality in our state and across the nation. We have seen that both through modeling and through pilot projects that have already been underway, that it increases labor force participation to have a universal basic income, and that it could potentially add $515 billion to the national economy. And so, you know, I think we have a lot to learn about these programs before we scale it to a national universal basic income. But having a project like Madison is about to embark on, one of actually 15 cities that eventually will be in piloting this model. You know, we will have a lot of test data, a lot of analysis. We'll be able to determine what the amount should be. Most of the current modeling looks at $1,000 per month, so $12,000 per year. That's still not very much money. That's still, you know, not a family sustaining wage.
Poverty.
Exactly. It is absolutely still poverty. But what we see is that when people have that basic income, they can rely on $1,000 a month coming in. They use that as sort of a worker support fund. And so they're able to pay for childcare or housing or transportation or food, the things that make it possible for families to fully engage in the labor market. And when they don't have that, it becomes very difficult, even with our other safety net programs, for them just to have the stability of income in order to fully participate and prepare for jobs that would be providing them a family sustaining wage.
We're speaking with Michelle Mackey, the new head of Kids Forward. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're assessing the state of Wisconsin children and families this morning. How should Wisconsin prioritize social needs? What do you think of Governor Tony Evers' emphasis on equity in his proposed budget? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. With us is Michelle Mackey, the new leader of the organization Kids Forward. And I want to go to the phones because we have a listener joining us from Milwaukee this morning. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, ladies. This may seem off topic, but it's people who live in poverty live in despair and under constant stress. And therefore, drugs have a major grip on people of poverty. That is why I believe our state must legalize marijuana. By doing so, they're going to take out an entire level of crime of selling and buying, and it will be easier for people to get it, and they won't have to go and get it from drug pushers. I think people should study the states that have legalized marijuana and see what the impact has been on poor people.
Thanks, Bill. Michelle Mackey, does Kids Forward weigh in on the question of drug legalization and marijuana specifically?
We haven't analyzed, done what Bill suggested yet, which is to look at the potential impact for Wisconsin, given what we've seen in other states. We have, however, looked at the fact that the governor included that in his budget and the possible fiscal impact of that. And as an organization that looks at both the expenditures that we could do in order to help children and families, we also look at the revenue possibilities to fund those programs. And I think it has been proven or shown across the country where states have enacted or legalized marijuana that there is a revenue benefit to that. And so we will be doing more research on that, more analysis of what that benefit could be, as well as looking at the impact for the juvenile justice system, the criminal justice system. As an organization that advocates strongly on racial justice topics, that we look to advance racial equity, this is clearly a space where disparity is so prevalent that if you are a white kid and you are caught with marijuana, your outcome is going to be completely different. You will probably wind up back at home and going to school and not having very many critical consequences, whereas if you're a Black kid, you are very likely to be in the juvenile justice system. And it only advances from there, depending on your age and your entry into the criminal justice system. And so we do not think that that is the direction that we should have been in, or nor the direction we should be going in. So both from the fiscal side of it and the disparity side of it, we are very intrigued by the possibilities of what legalization could mean for Wisconsin, and invite folks to visit kidsforward.org over the next year or two. And I'm sure we will have more about exactly why we feel the way we feel.
So one of the things that the governor is proposing in his budget is changing the way we prosecute minors, 17-year-olds specifically, mm-hmm. putting them back in the juvenile justice system, not trying them as adults. Why would this matter?
This is very important. We are one of three states that has not raised the age of adult jurisdiction to 18. And that doesn't mean that there will never be a 17-year-old that goes into the criminal justice system, that there won't be offenses that is appropriate for. But it won't be an automatic determination that a 17-year-old is in the criminal justice system as opposed to the juvenile justice system. That is very important because what we've learned over the past decades is that brain development shows that 17-year-olds are still very much young people. They are still very much children in terms of their reactions, in terms of their ability to control their behavior. And in terms of their ability to rehabilitate and to destroy a life at that age by putting someone into the criminal justice system for often what are, you know, these offenses like marijuana possession or something like that, is not the direction that our nation has gone to, and certainly is not the direction that Wisconsin should go into, especially since it has the worst Black incarceration rates in the nation, and is really a good reason or a reason for some of the disparity that we're seeing in the Black community. So yes, we are very involved in the Raise the Age effort. We were working with partners in Milwaukee Youth Justice. We have started a statewide platform for that work. And we just released a report earlier this year, sponsored by the Department of Justice, that shows that there are alternatives to even the juvenile justice system. When you're faced with a pandemic, you figure out alternatives to housing kids, to detaining kids. And so we're very excited about that work. We're very excited to dig into some other options that were explored during the pandemic.
We're speaking with Michelle Mackey, the new head of Kids Forward, which promotes opportunities for children and families throughout Wisconsin. And we're taking your questions, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. We have Steve joining us. Good morning, Steve.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I do volunteer work in some of the inner city around the Madison area and work with some disadvantaged kids. And one of the things that's always frustrating for me is to hear how disheartened they are about their prospects. And I try to explain to them that, you know, you're going to have a changing demographics where you're going to have more people in wheelchairs than you do in strollers. There's such a great opportunity for everybody if they make good decisions. Go to school, don't do drugs, don't have children before you're ready. Make those choices and you're going to be fine. And I think it's disheartening that we have leaders that try to sell them systematic racism when they saying they can't get ahead when they can.
What do you think would help, Steve?
I think preaching what I just stated. Exactly what I just stated. There are opportunities that are out there. I've been in management now for 30 years. I've known people in management for 30 years. I can tell you, in not one aspect of my life has anyone said, I am not hiring somebody because of their skin color or what dangles between their legs.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Michelle, what do you think about that, about the power of hope and opportunity and outlook?
Hope and opportunity are very powerful. And when combined with a world that is not built on racism within our systems, there is great potential, exactly what Steve was saying. But I think it is not correct to say that we do not have systems that preference certain people over other people. Individuals may not be preferencing. Systems are built in a way that in order to allocate resources, in order to give opportunity, they have been built that has embedded within them preference. And so that is what organizations like Kids Forward works on. We also very much support the fact that there are assets in communities, and we uplift those assets, and we talk to communities about how their assets also provide opportunity, also provide them a voice in which to make the change. But if you talk to communities of color, if you talk to impacted rural people, they understand that zip code for rural folks and skin color for communities of color, or ethnic background, language for communities of color, immigration status for communities of color, that absolutely impacts their opportunity and their access. And so it is both hope and assets in a community all give you the potential for success and to be thriving member of society. But we also have these systemic issues that we must deal with.
And Michelle, before I lose you, I just wonder what you think about the state Supreme Court striking down Governor Evers' mask mandate and the impact on those individuals getting the extra food aid that was contingent upon that public health emergency.
Oh, yes, we are. I think we actually have been writing about this quite a bit. And so, again, check out kidsforward.org or wisconsinbudgetproject.org for more details. But, basically, Kids Forward is a data-informed policy center. We rely on data, just like public health relies on data. We have seen that both the quantitative data, the hard numbers, and the lived experience of communities, that this is very dangerous. That we will have masks are a very easy public health tool. And we will have an increase, a surge, and unfortunately, we will also lose out on federal funding. For SNAP, for nutrition programs for children and
Yes.
families,
Yes.
because we are not having our masks.
Well, thank you, Michelle, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Michelle Mackey is Chief Executive Officer of Kids Forward. Up next is news. Then we learn the latest on the trial of Derek Chauvin. This is The Morning Show. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're heading into day four of the Derek Chauvin murder trial. This is the former Minneapolis police officer who forcibly restrained George Floyd outside a convenience store last Memorial Day, kneeling on his neck for nearly 9 minutes as he gasped for breath. Chauvin is accused of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. How does this case make you feel about criminal justice in America? What would justice look like to you in this case? We're at 1-800-642-1234, ideas@wpr.org. India Yancey Bragg is a race and diversity reporter with USA Today. She's covering the trial from Minneapolis. Good morning, India.
Morning.
So prosecutors have been laying out the case. What have been the main takeaways so far?
The takeaways are so far have been most witnesses that they've called so far have been eyewitnesses to the event, with the exception of the first witness and the last witness that we've heard from. And the video that many people have taken, body camera videos, those have been kind of the star witnesses, I think, for the prosecution, showing what happened in the course of the 9 minutes and 29 seconds that Derek Chauvin was on George Floyd's neck.
And so there's three different charges here. What are prosecutors, what are they attempting to prove here?
Yeah, so the prosecutors have to prove that Derek Chauvin's actions were a substantial cause of death or a substantial contributing factor to George Floyd's death. And they have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that Chauvin caused Floyd's death while assaulting him in order to prove second degree unintentional murder. For third degree murder, that's a little bit more challenging. It's not more challenging, it's more complicated. They have to prove that Chauvin caused the death of George Floyd by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind. And for second-degree manslaughter, prosecutors have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that Chauvin was culpably negligent and took an unreasonable risk with Floyd's life.
And so you mentioned the videos playing the star role throughout the trial so far. We heard from the teenager whose video went viral, who captured the event on their cell phone. What was her testimony like?
It was incredibly emotional, as many of the witnesses have been. She talked about how she stayed up at night apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more to save his life.
We also heard from firefighters. What did you hear themes throughout the witnesses?
I think that guilt that I was talking about is a big theme that has come up with many of the witnesses. Firefighter Genevieve Hansen feels like she could have provided medical aid to Floyd. And she asked, she can be heard in the video asking officers to check his pulse. And she talks about how she should have intervened medically. And we heard from the cashier at the Cup Foods who took the counterfeit $20 bill from Mr. Floyd. And he said something to the effect of, if I had just not said anything to my manager about that bill, Mr. Floyd might still be alive.
Right. So many of these witnesses taking on the responsibility onto their own shoulders.
Exactly.
How's the defense team been so far?
With many of the minor witnesses, there were many people who witnessed the event that were younger than 18 at the time. The defense has had to be kind of careful. You know, Eric Nelson can't be that aggressive with them because, you know, their testimonies are incredibly emotional. But he has gotten combative at times with the firefighter, for example. There was a very heated exchange where Judge Peter Cahill sent the jury out of the room and reprimanded Hansen for not answering the defense's questions. He's also gotten kind of combative with Donald Williams, who was a mixed martial arts fighter who was very vocal. He can be heard on the video, you know, asking Chauvin to get off of George Floyd. And I think that he is trying to characterize the crowd that was there that day as angry and large and threatening to the officers. And people are pretty resistant to characterizing themselves as angry. They will accept that they were upset and that they may have raised their voice, but they say that is in response to what they saw.
Yeah. What's the mood been in like inside the courtroom? What are you feeling? What can you see that we can't see not being there?
So I haven't actually been inside the courtroom yet because the reporters are rotating for a spot there. But I've read pool reports from people who have been actually inside. And one thing that I noted yesterday was that the mood seemed to shift very quickly when the graphic video was being played. Some jurors looked away, some were watching. You know, there's a Floyd family member in the courtroom almost every day. And I know yesterday it was Rodney Floyd, and he wouldn't watch the video.
Mm. Have you been outside in the community, outside the courthouse?
Yeah, I'm typically in the building next door watching. And so I remember on the first day of jury selection, there was quite a large crowd, like right away in the morning. And on the first day of the trial this week, there was a large crowd that gathered in the evening.
And what were they doing?
Oh, to protest and just to make their voices heard and to let there's a lot of, I think, tension and anger in the city and not a lot of expectation that Chauvin will be convicted. And so people are just letting the world know that they're watching the trial.
What do you think might happen after the trial concludes?
It's hard to say. I can't predict how the trial is going to go, especially because I haven't actually been able to look at the jury myself. But I think that if Chauvin is acquitted, I think there's a high probability that protests could break out again.
Have you talked to the protesters? Are they saying anything particular about how they feel and what they might intend to do?
Yeah, I think people, like I was saying, people are not very hopeful that Chauvin will get convicted, and they're angry, they're upset, and, many people have expressed that it's not just George Floyd, it is the legacy of and the history of policing in this country that is fueling this kind of the tension, I think. People are worried about how this trial is going to go.
Yeah. What do you know about the case the defense is making for Derek Chauvin?
Yeah, so Eric Nelson, who is the lead defense attorney, in his opening statement, he focused a lot on Floyd's existing health issues and his drug use. And he basically has to try to get the jury to forget about the videos. And he said something to the effect of this case is about more than 9 minutes and 29 seconds, you know, and he is going to focus heavily on what was Mr. Floyd's cause of death and try to prove that it occurred as a result of hypertension or coronary disease and the ingestion of methamphetamine and fentanyl. And he is also, as I was saying before, making the argument that the officers were feeling threatened by the crowd and that, you know, Mr. Floyd outweighs Mr. Chauvin. And so the officers had to control him. And that is sort of the case that he's been making so far.
And how long is this trial expected to last?
I believe it's scheduled for 4 weeks, and then it will go into jury deliberations.
Mm-hmm. Has the $27 million the settlement to George Floyd's family, the separate case, has that come up so far?
Yeah, it has come up during jury selection because that is when the city announced it, and it became a point of contention because seven jurors had already been selected at that point. And so Cahill had to call them back in and, you know, ask them how they felt about learning about the settlement and if it would affect their ability to be impartial. And two people were dismissed after saying that it did. So Cahill was not particularly happy about that.
Mm-hmm. And how has Cahill been handling the case so far?
I think he's been really trying to keep things moving. There was some concern that it would be delayed with the addition of the third-degree murder charge and, you know, with the settlement. I think he's really been trying to keep things efficient. And there have been moments where I think his temper has kind of flared up, like as I mentioned with Genevieve Hansen earlier this week. But I think he's been fairly even-keeled and, you know, jovial with the jurors and trying to make people feel comfortable. But, yeah, trying to keep things moving.
We're speaking with India Yancey Bragg, who is a reporter with USA Today. She's been covering the trial in Minneapolis. You're listening to The Morning Show, and I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about the Derek Chauvin murder trial happening now in Minneapolis, and we're taking your questions. What would justice look like to you in this case? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas@wpr.org. We're speaking to India Yancey Bragg, reporter for USA Today, who's been in Minneapolis all week covering the trial. Now, India, earlier this week, you published a news report that looked at the trauma that the death of George Floyd caused Black teens in Minneapolis. What did they tell you?
A lot of people told me that when they looked at George Floyd, they saw their brothers, they saw their fathers, they saw their friends, and kids especially are worried about growing up and interacting with police and being viewed as threatening because they are Black. And many of them are worried that this trial is going to be re-traumatizing for them because, I mean, the video was played maybe seven times yesterday. So for people that are watching, they have to see this really graphic video over and over again.
What did the mental health experts you talked to say about this?
They said that this trial is particularly difficult for the people involved, the witnesses, and that it's going to impact them for the rest of their life. And it's also difficult for teens who are just starting to understand what it means to be Black in America, and they're forming their own racial identities. And, you know, it teaches them at a young age that there are things that they have to worry about that other kids don't. And it can cause, you know, anxiety and depression. It can cause kids to become isolated and, you know, there are not enough mental health resources available for young Black teens in the city, I think.
Yeah. Is there any effort happening in Minneapolis now, any kind of mental health support?
There certainly is. There are, you know, Black mental health professionals that are, you know, opening up spaces in high schools so that kids can talk about how they feel. And there are kids, too, teens that are trying to pull together resources and, you know, create one teen in particular. I'm thinking of, he's trying to create a social media page that has a list of all these resources to just kind of encourage people to take advantage of what's already out there.
Yeah. We're speaking with India Yancey Bragg, reporter for USA Today, who has been covering the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. And I wonder, India, as you look, you're there in Minneapolis, you're looking at the media coverage, both locally and nationally, I imagine. Are you noticing trends in how this is being covered? I mean, this story is everywhere, leading newscasts. Have you noticed differences in local press?
Yeah, I mean, the local media coverage has just been outstanding. I feel like I read the Star Tribune like every day. I think local media is really on top of this and covering a lot of the different angles. It feels like the things that I notice and that I'm talking about, they show up immediately, you know, online or in the paper the next day. Particularly what I was mentioning before about the Eric Nelson trying to paint the crowd as angry, and the resistance to that from some of the witnesses. I saw a story in the Tribune on that. So local media coverage has been really excellent. And I mean, there's reporters from around the world that are in the media center across the street watching the trial every day. So I think media coverage has been really extensive. And I think that can be hard for residents in the city who, you know, they're getting interviewed multiple times, people at protests, you know, you seeing the similar voices being elevated sometimes.
Yeah, I imagine it must be hard to sequester the jurors and kind of insulate them from the media coverage. Do you know to what degree that's happening?
I don't think that they have been sequestered at this point, but they, you know, Cahill has asked all of them to kind of stay away from social media. And he has this line, like, you don't have to refuse to speak to anybody, but, you know, they can't talk about being on this jury. And so, you know, if you can't tell people, you know, I'm a juror, please don't talk to me about this. How do you avoid learning about it when it seems like it's so prevalent? So, yeah, I think it's definitely been a challenge. And that's why the settlement was so difficult to avoid having jurors learn about it, because it just people covered it.
Right, right. So it's not like they're holed up in a hotel room somewhere with, you know, no TV and no internet. They're
exactly.
Going about their everyday lives.
Yeah. And I mean, if you go on Facebook, you'll probably see something about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unavoidable. I mean, how much do you think that settlement is a factor here, is going to weigh into this case?
Well, I don't think that at this point it'll weigh in anymore, because, you know, it's a separate legal case, and I don't think that the prosecution is going to bring it up. The defense certainly won't want to bring it up. So I don't think it will play into the actual drama in the courtroom anymore, but it certainly had an impact on trying to find an impartial jury, which was, you know, already a challenge enough.
Mm-hmm. And what do you expect to see at the trial today?
Today we're expecting more witnesses for the prosecution, I believe. I don't have an advanced witness list of who they're going to call, but it seems like they are moving away from eyewitnesses, and the last witness yesterday was a police officer, so they may be getting into the police training aspect today, but I really don't know.
What will you be watching for?
I tend to watch for those kind of emotional moments. So far, it's been incredibly emotional, particularly when the video was played. And so that's what I tend to keep an eye out for.
Yeah, the moments that we're going to remember, we're going to be talking about from years from this moment.
Exactly. And, you know, it's also interesting to see, you know, eventually we're going to get into medical testimony and we're going to get police officers. I believe Police Chief Aaron Bondo is going to be testifying at some point. So I think it's going to get into the more technical aspects of the case at some point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the community members, given that you've said this trial could go on for weeks on end, do you think the community members are going to stay with it? Are they going to maintain a presence from those you've talked to outside the courtroom?
I don't know. On the first day of jury selection and the first day of the trial, there was a big presence. But day to day, it's a couple people outside, because I think that people are at home watching. I think, you know, I was kind of surprised that everyone that I spoke to, you know, they appeared to spend a good amount of time watching jury selection, which, you know, it's not even, you know, the evidence at that point. So I think people are really glued to the screen on this.
Yeah. We're speaking with India Yancey Bragg, a race and diversity reporter with USA Today. She's been covering the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who's been charged with murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. And we want to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org. What do you think about the trial so far? Are you following it? How is it impacting you? 1-800-642-1234. Now, India, you're on the race and diversity beat with USA Today. What has that entailed so far for you?
The protests over the summer were kind of, that's when I transitioned to this beat. So that was kind of my introduction to what I would be covering. I've covered the rise in Asian hate crimes. And so it's been a wide range of issues, certainly.
Yeah. Not a slow beat this year, India.
Unfortunately, no.
No, there's a lot to deal with, a lot going on. How long will you stay in Minneapolis?
I am in and out during the trial. I'm here for the first 2 weeks, and then I'll be back for the final weekend. Whenever we reach a verdict, I'll be here.
And you mentioned that the police chief, it's expected that the police chief would testify. Do you have any insight or knowledge of what that might look like? Why that would happen? What we would learn?
I can't say for sure what they're going to call him in for, but it was discussed in some pretrial motions about whether or not the jury is going to hear the reasons and the reasons behind why Chauvin and the other three officers involved were fired so quickly, which was a decision announced by the chief. And so I think it may get into that aspect of, did Chauvin follow his police training or not? But I can't say for sure.
Sure. Well, we have a call for you, India. I want to go next to Tomo, where we have Joseph joining us. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning.
What's your question?
My question is kind of in regards to the police training that will likely be brought up as part of the defense and part of the prosecution, that Derek Chauvin was just acting in regards to what he's been trained to do. And if that is a solid defense, will there be any expectation for reforms in police training going forward?
Great question.
Yeah, well, I think that there have already been some attempts to make changes to the police training in Minneapolis after George Floyd's death, you know, the banning of chokeholds and, you know, some limits on no-knock warrants, I believe. But it came up in opening statements where the prosecution, basically Attorney Blackwell, was saying when someone is in your custody, they're in your care. And so I think that it's going to be a big point of contention for the prosecution that Chauvin was not following his training and that he should have, you know, provided medical care to George Floyd.
Yes, well, we will continue to follow your coverage in USA Today, India. Best of luck to you as you cover this case and hear this testimony, listening to all the witnesses and following and reporting on it for USA Today. I really want to thank you for being here this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with India Yancey Bragg, a race and diversity reporter with USA Today. She's been covering the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who's been charged with murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. Just ahead is the news. Then we'll dig into the cases of so-called COVID long haulers, those who've had the virus but still have symptoms even months later. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.